This is House Planning Help, episode 381. Hello, I'm Ben Adam Smith, and this is the podcast for you if you're interested in building new or tackling a retrofit project. I'm exploring what houses we should be building in the 21st century and trying to break down the major roadblocks that may get in our way. Coming up in this session, my guest is self-builder Phil Neave. In the last episode, we found out about the Passive House Plus certification and looked at a few case studies. Well, today we're focusing on Passive House Premium, and there aren't so many of those about yet. However, Phil is working on one, so we'll find out more details about his project. And overall, it's a brilliant sustainable project. I've said it before and I'll say it again, digging into the details of other projects is a great way to learn. And that's obviously what we do on this podcast. We need to seize all the opportunities, but there's another opportunity because we now have the winners of the Exemplar Sustainable Building Awards. I mentioned this in the last episode, but it's a one-off event to celebrate the 20th anniversary of the Sustainable Development Foundation. And it brings together two alliance partners, that is the Alliance for Sustainable Building Products and the Passive House Trust. So what that means in practice is all of our buildings have proven performance. They're not just saying, oh, it'll be really good, really energy efficient. They've modelled it beforehand. They know it's going to work. There's been an as-built check. And then the careful choice of materials. We need to follow the trail. Are these healthy materials? What do we know about them? And embodied carbon, all those sorts of things. So it's that intersection. And that's why I think you should really spend some time. Maybe this is a Sunday job here. Pouring a cup of coffee, sitting down in front of your computer or tablet or whatever you like, and just going through some of the details of the project, watching the videos. Enjoy. So we'll work that into the show notes today. Let's get to our featured interview with self-builder Phil Neave. We've got a few aspects to drill down on today. Passive House Premium, yes, I've mentioned that. Also, our case study, which is Phil's house build, is in open countryside. And getting permission for a project like this, it's not always a given. It's laborious, it's expensive. So we'll find out how he's navigated it. Maybe he's just sailed through and it's been an absolutely wonderful experience. Let's mark this up as a part one as well. So we're covering all the work that's going to get us to construction. I started by asking Phil to tell me a little bit about his background.
Many years ago, I was a sort of poor scientist, oceanographer, but had a deep interest even from my teens in what we used to call alternative energy and very specific things like solar systems and so forth. Went off and did lots of other things for about 20 years and raised a family. And then just over 20 years ago, got back into the energy business through an energy consultancy dealing with domestic energy efficiency programs. And then 20 years ago, decided to head off back to CAT in Mahuntleth to do the AES master's degree in architecture and energy and environment. From there, I became an energy assessor. And in 2010, along with people like Jay Cottrell and some others, trained as a passive house designer because I could see that passive house was the, if you like, the best and the way to go and the way we had to go. And for the last 15 years, well, up till I retired a couple of years ago, I've been working as pretty much entirely on low energy and passive house buildings. And for the last few years with passive house homes, as you're probably aware. So yeah. So I have some background in that.
And then you must have come up with the idea of building your own house.
Yeah, about probably 6 or 7 years ago, I've got a piece of land I've owned since 2010, which I didn't buy to build a house on. I bought it to run a horticulture project on, which I still do. But the idea came into my head through various other people doing various things locally. And I thought, well, maybe I could get permission. I thought I could never get permission being open countryside. But then I thought about it and decided that possibly I could. And I'd been involved in quite a lot of Para 79 as they were, and Para 80, then now Para 84 buildings, and thought, well, if there's one route to getting planning permission, that's probably it, being that this is open countryside. And I'd always had an interest in some specific forms of architecture, such as earth sheltering and so forth. So we looked at a lot of different ideas. But about 5 years ago, we came up with a sort of core ideas that have led to the design and to the project we're now hoping to get planning for any minute.
And you weren't worried, because a lot of the projects that I see that get that planning permission end up costing an absolute fortune.
Yeah, well, they do. And so is mine, a lot more than I had expected and a lot more than I really could afford technically to spend on planning. Maybe I should, in hindsight, have tried an ordinary planning application first, but it is open countryside. There's no building on there, so there's no potential for a Class Q redundant farm buildings dwelling. And knowing the council round here, knowing the general atmosphere, it was going to be turned down and very difficult to get. Maybe at appeal, but maybe not. I didn't know that at the time. So I decided, well, let's go for broke. We'll go for a Para 80 house. Para 84, as it is now, is the what's known as the mansion clause, introduced way back in the late 1990s. It now reads something to the effect of, it has to be a design of exceptional quality, truly outstanding, reflecting the highest standards in architecture, helping to raise standards of design more generally in rural areas, and significantly enhancing its immediate setting. So it's basically saying you've got to come up with something that is a bit special to be allowed to build it on essentially agricultural land. Now, I was already aware that just building, for example, just a passive house and being very green was not going to cut the mustard. It had to be more than that. It had to be architecturally, visually good, as well as have a lot more to it. So the project is really underpinned by good design, interesting design, exceptional performance, very exceptional performance, and also integration with the environment and nature, and ultimately aiming to improve everything, not damage anything, in very simple terms. So Para 80 is tough. If you want to know how tough, it's taken me over 4 years, and it's cost a very large sum of money, getting close to a six-figure sum.
Well, when you started, did you think, I'm going to do a lot of the legwork myself, I've got a bit more time? Or did you think, I know someone who's going to help me here, I need a planning specialist? How did it work? How did you assemble your team or your approach?
I felt that I was lucky in that I had a background in building and construction and in energy and environmentally sound building, if you like. So I knew I had a bit of an advantage there, but I was fully aware that it would still require a lot of help. So yes, definitely a planning consultant, a good architect, and some other consultants. I ended up having to have, I think it's 10 consultants involved. So there's architecture, planning, landscape design, ecology, highways and highway safety, lighting, believe it or not. And in addition to all that, and that was in some cases like two sets of consultants on one subject, then there was design review, the design review process using an independent design panel, which again is long-winded, complex, difficult, expensive. So I knew that was coming. I'd put aside a budget of less than half what I've spent, thinking we should try and do this on the cheap. I'm trying to prove that the exceptional house design, the exceptional house permission should not just be for big, huge, monstrous mansions. It should be for exceptional small buildings or relatively small buildings, ordinary buildings, and buildings showing that they don't cost a fortune. Maybe I was a little naive there, but I still believe to some degree we will be achieving something of that. Though to get that exceptional quality, you sometimes have to go a bit further than you maybe would like.
Yeah, I'm sure we're going to find out more as the conversation progresses. But what was your vision then? What did you want to do when you thought you knew enough to know that this has to be special? So what did special mean to you, and how were you going to approach it?
I absolutely have a gut belief, an unshakable belief that we can build really great buildings, really efficient, comfortable, healthy buildings. We have the skills and knowledge to do it. We have the materials to do it. And we're not doing it in volume. And so I wanted to do something that was yet another look. If I can do this, this well, for this cost, why can't everybody else? Because the building industry, quite frankly, lives in the dark ages. It's awful. What most people are offered to buy when they're buying a new house is, well, in my opinion, rubbish. And it needn't be. It's a real shame, but it needn't be. So my first aim really was to do something that said, you can do it better. Anybody can do it better. And you can do it better as a self-builder, as a sweat equity self-builder, which I will be. That meant that I wanted it to have great performance. And as a passive house designer, I was able to influence design from day one, which is what you have to do in order to help deliver that. It had to look good. It's got to be beautiful to at least some people, though, you know, the architectural criticism is a very subjective thing. And some people will, Prince Charles would hate it, but then I don't like his stuff. Sorry, King Charles. And finally, I think it had to meet two other major objectives. It had to be very low carbon. We live in a climate emergency where I believe that we should be pushing that carbon budget right down as far as we can. Lastly, and somewhat differently, maybe slightly exceptionally, environmentally, I wanted it to do as much as possible, not just not do too much damage, but actually what I describe, what I call a beneficial house. So essentially, once you've built it, the environment and the local ecology certainly is better and more diverse and more vibrant than it was when you started. So I'm starting with a green field, unimproved grassland, not ecologically a desert, but not ecologically wonderful. What I end up with, I hope, will be better than that.
Yeah, it's a great vision, and I can see exactly why you want to do this. Back to that aesthetic, what does that mean for you then? Was it about the materials you were going to choose? What part of that is going to make this striking and to tick that box?
All of those things. Materials matter. You need to have materials that are sympathetic, empathetic with the environment, but they don't necessarily have to be traditional. You know, I don't want to build in stone. There's a lot of stone around here, but there is no real vernacular. We're here in North Somerset. We've got stone, we've got timber, we've got Wrigley tin, we've got brick, a lot more stone than most things, but not exclusively. There are fashions in materials, as there are fashions in design shapes and design keys, which I'm not too keen on yet again aping everything else, though there's nothing new under the sun. So, and I wanted to build low carbon and very environmentally friendly, which means to me predominantly timber. So we will be looking in terms of materials at quite a lot of timber on the finishes as well as the structure, but also renders, lime renders on part of the building as well, which again are used around here and give a different vibe. From a form point of view, I'm a modernist. I like modern buildings. There are some great ones and some awful ones. And again, the tendency for vast amounts of glass, glazed gables, the sort of thing that you just see time and time again that firstly is becoming a bit hackneyed, but also doesn't work very well from an energy and especially an overheating point of view. And just touching on that subject, as a building professional, that I see as the biggest problem we have potentially is overheating and has been for some time, and it's really got to be addressed. So all those things, plus the desire to achieve a very high standard of energy efficiency and energy production, means that you're pushed to certain forms and certain ideas. And then we evolve those. And in my case, it was the concept of a wedge-shaped house with a single pitch roof facing south, a very simple design with some potential problems, but working around them early, we come up with a design which works very well.
And I'm not sure we've mentioned passive house premium, but this was your goal, wasn't it?
One of them, yes. The reason being that it delivers what we want in terms of energy. use reduction and cost in terms of internal environment being good temperatures, warm, comfortable, not having an overheating issue, having high air quality, all those things come out of building to passive house when it's properly done. So there was a simple prosaic reason I wanted to do it to start with, only one reason, and it's not the whole story. And that was, at the time we started, there wasn't one. There was no passive house premium dwelling. There was one other building, a very large college building in Northern Ireland, and that was the only one in the UK. There is now, I believe, one house in the Cotswolds which has been certified. So we won't be the first anymore, but it's still not exactly common. So I wanted to achieve it if we could.
Well, we need to unpack it some more. But just before we do that, what size of floor area did you end up going for and how did you arrive at that?
I started when I was living on my own. I now have a new partner. I started looking at a two-bedroom house around about 120, 140 square meters. After we'd started the project, I met my current partner and we discussed this building that I wanted to put up. And that discussion led to us think, well, no, we need to make this more of a standard family house, a three-bedroom, three to four-bedroom family house. So we've gone up to about 230 square meters. So it's not an enormous mansion. And it does that on two floors. It does it on a sloping site. And we wanted to make sure that this building was a fully accessible building and that you could get in and out on either floor, that you could move between floors. So, you know, I'm getting older. If I'm in a wheelchair, can I use this building? Yes, I can. So there's a whole lot of things like that that were involved in those early design decisions that meant that what we evolved, I believe, works very well. And in terms of passive house, it's all about form. So it's all about the ratio of the envelope of the building to the amount of floor area. And a good form factor is around about 2. A poor form factor is above 4. Average is 3. Mine comes in at 3. And very early modelling, which we always try and do as early as possible, showed that it achieved the passive house standard, that we could achieve passive house premium with the PV array on the roof of the building alone, which I wanted to do. I didn't want any extra panels off the building, and that the overheating risk with the design we developed was 0.
Can you describe what passive house premium means?
Well, let's jump through passive house standards. Passive house classic is just about the energy consumption. It has to achieve a maximum energy use per year or per square meter. And it has to have triple glazing. It has to have very good airtightness below 0.6. Passive House Plus then adds some renewables to the extent that it generates as much energy as it uses. Now, that means that in the summer, it'll be exporting spare energy to the grid. And in the winter, it will be importing some. But it balances its annual use with its generation. Passive House Premium does more. It takes the floor area of the building and says, this bit of land potentially has the capability of achieving a certain standard with a certain number of floors and a certain amount of generation. And I actually don't understand the calculation 100% myself, but it is related to that area and it then determines how much energy you must produce from that building. So for the same footprint, but a taller building that's got more living space, you can put a similar amount of energy generation, costs less per unit, but it's what you achieve on that floor. Now, that means that it produces generally 2 to 3 or even sometimes 4 times the energy it's going to use. That building, therefore, during the winter will very rarely import energy. It nearly always produces enough energy to run itself. And a lot of the year, it will produce quite a large excess, which you can use for other things or gets exported to the grid. So this starts to actually affect the carbon calculations or operational carbon because you are producing zero carbon energy or very low carbon energy on top of what you need.
So does this impact the shape of the house and your thoughts about what you can have? You couldn't just, you know, passive house in itself, you talked about form factor, that's important. Does this get even more? You've got to really think what's going to work in your favour.
Yeah, you have to have a grasp of the basic principles. So passive house does not have to be a boring box. One of the classic myths, all passive houses are cubes. No, they're not. This is an interesting shape. It's not the most efficient shape. It's a compromise. By using this shape, I've got a fantastic south-facing roof for my PV collectors. So we will have around about 22, maybe a little bit more, 22 kilowatts of PV on one roof, all facing due south. Very efficient. It does mean we have some sloping ceilings and some slightly odd shapes that we have to deal with that make it less efficient from an overall point of view, but it still works. That's one of the compromises. And it also gives an interesting aesthetic. But what we're doing is we're playing with this from day one. We're drawing something and we're quickly doing an assessment through PHPP of how that's performing. So if we move on to another issue, for example, which is solar gain and overheating. So you need solar gain to keep the house warm and add to your energy inputs in the winter. So I have, for example, on the ground floor, large windows facing south, which will collect that winter energy, but they have a very big overhang of about a meter or so, which will protect them from overheating in the summer. I like east-facing bedrooms because I like waking up to the sun. But big east windows are even worse for overheating because the sun is hot and low and penetrates under any overhang, so you have to come up with different solutions. We have a big overhang and a big balcony, but we also have vertical shading. But not just vertical shading physically, we're going to grow plants up the side of that building. So it's nothing new. It's been done for thousands of years. And those plants in the summer will grow up and shade those rooms enough, again, to prevent the overheating. They're actually using the building as a place to grow things. So we'll be growing things like hops, vines. So we're growing food and shading the building. So it's kind of things like that, which come through this iterative process between architect and energy nerd. My architect saying, I would like to do this. I'm going, no, you can't do that. Doesn't work. Or I'm saying, I'd like to do this. And he says, well, how can I make that work? So there's a lot of things going on there.
And how did you decide who to work with? Because you've got a lot of experience over the years, so there must have been a fair choice.
Yeah, I know a lot of architects. I have a particular architect, a friend of mine, Mark Ellerby, who I'd worked with on a number of buildings over a number of years. Like me, you know, one-man band, good design ideas, was prepared to work with my ideas. It was not too egotistical. Some architects will just tell you what they want to do and they won't entertain anything different. And I needed to have some control and input in this, not alone for the energy, but I just wanted to. And I wanted to have some influence on what this thing looked like because it was very important to me that it fitted into the landscape. No client architect relationship is perfect, believe you me. And we've had our moments. But what we have done is over that 4-year period now, 5 years we've been working on the design, we've managed to work our way through all those things and come out with something that works. And that ultimately satisfied the design review panel, who said, yes, it's great, go ahead.
So getting planning permission, was it down to all of this work that we've talked about and low energy, low carbon, generation, improving the biodiversity? Is that what's going to get it through and get it the green light?
Yes. In essence, yes. You have to look at everything. There was a time when you could go in with some wacky idea like, you know, I'm going to power it on angels' tears, which I extract from pixie mines. And if you could show that it was going to do it, some people would say, oh, yeah, that's great. That was in the days where the word innovation was in the Para 55 originally. That got taken out, that innovation was not enough. And it comes down now to a much more subjective and a difficult to assess sort of measure of a panel of experts, you know, a panel of design professionals, architects and landscape people and so forth, who decide, do we think this is outstanding? I mean, one of the early difficulties was getting the highways on board and allowing us to create an entrance that they were happy with. You know, highways design lives a bit in the past as well. It's all predicated on car speeds, not on actual people and usage. But we had to solve that problem, which we managed to do. So that was dealt with. And then there's a lot of work had to go in on justifying the history of the design. How did that design evolve? You have to show your workings, you show your homework, if you like, that we got to this point because we went through these steps, not just here's something great, but this is how we got to something great. And the third and biggest thing has been ecology. I've had more bat surveys than you've had hot dinners. I went to my ecologist. I said, I want you to tell me everything I can do to improve this site and improve the biodiversity of this site. And we will do that. But you have to also persuade other people that you mean it. And then there are all the rules and regulations. And the requirement for biodiversity net gain calculations in general are at conflict with those that have to be done for the bat populations. And you have to show that the bats aren't going to be disturbed. And we had to have light spill surveys that model 3D model a house to show that the light coming from the room light fittings is not going to disturb the bats. Da, di, da, di, da. There is a huge number of technical things that have to be done, as well as persuading somebody this is actually quite an exceptional building. And as I said, I'd hoped to have planning last week. I have probably got to wait another 2 to 3 weeks because English Nature are also involved and I'm waiting for their approval. But yeah, it's the whole package. And I would say to anybody embarking on a Power 84 house, you have to look at everything in detail early, predict the problems, and be ready to go out and spend the money to get the answers to show that you've dealt with them.
Is it a very tricky thing to cost up how much money you're going to invest in getting planning permission?
I think if you speak to the real experts, people like Richard Hawkes, who have done, I think, about 50 paragraph 80 houses. Well, two things I've been told. One is that as a client, you surrender all rights to any ideas or opinions to the architect, which was something I had to resist a bit. And I wanted some input, as I've explained earlier. The second thing is you've got to spend £100,000.
Wow.
That's pretty much it.
Okay. Well, that ticks that one off. Okay, let's go back to Passive House Premium then for a second. Do you also need to make sure that when you plug back into the grid that they can take what you're going to generate? Is that part of the process and how do you navigate that?
Absolutely. Luckily, I've had a bit of background in PV and in generation, so I knew some of the rules already. If you're putting this amount of PV on a house, or even if you've got a wind turbine, you're putting in excess of 4 or 5 kilowatts into the grid, you need special permissions. And when you get up to that level, you're absolutely into a three-phase supply. So about a year and a bit ago, there was no supply to the site. So I got a supply fitted, a three-phase supply into the site, and that's ready to go. Didn't cost me too much because I'm quite close to the power lines. So it cost me, I don't know, a couple of thousand quid to get that installed to a box. I then got to run it another 100 meters, which is going to cost a bit. But yeah, you have to have that done and ready. And it is possible that you might be in a place where they can't take that amount of power, so you couldn't do it. I had originally thought about doing it as an off-grid building, but I don't think it's certifiable unless you're able to export to the grid, because obviously, potentially, you're going to waste the energy you make, so it doesn't come into the play.
I've only been to one off-grid passive house, and then that has some other challenges. So,
yeah, I think off-grid is something you do if you have to. I think it's a slightly foolish decision to go off-grid if you don't have to. If you're on grid, you have the benefit of being able to bring in a bit of power when you need it, which may be very little, but you've got that. But secondly, all that stuff you're producing, you can chuck back in. A, it earns you money, but it means you are actually contributing to a low carbon grid. The other thing about off-grid is water. I firmly believe that the best and cheapest supply of clean water is the grid, i.e. mains water, and trying to produce your own is nuts. But again, it's a choice some people don't have, in which case, great, go for it.
And also with the Passive House Premium, maybe you could just explain, you know, what extra elements are in PHPP to help us model all of this.
So we are doing an extra calculation with regard to primary energy, but that's built into the sheet, the calculation sheet. All we have to do is tick the right box for that, and it does that for us. Then you're basically looking at, okay, how much of a renewable energy generation source have I got to put on before I hit the target that it calculates? And again, there are two different, it calculates it in two different ways. So there's some flexibility for different buildings as to how much you need. But the bottom line is mine comes out for a standard three-bedroomed house at around about 22 kilowatts. The average maximum array is about 4 kilowatts. That's what you can get on without planning permission. So it's six times the amount of energy.
And you were only ever going to use solar. For what reason? What did you not want, say, a wind turbine or whatever next to it?
I'd love a wind turbine next to it. I think the planners might be a little bit more circumspect about that. So might the neighbours. It's also very expensive. You know, you need quite a big turbine to put out even 5 kilowatts, whereas PV is a very simple technology. Just add the panels. It's not huge. It's about 100 square metres in total. It's easy to fit. It replaces the roof covering, so you're actually saving on, you know, I haven't got to buy a load of tiles because it's integrated into the roof. And yeah, it just works. It's the simplest way of working it. We are going into an all-electric world predominantly. So using PV, pushing that into a very small ground source heat pump, even more efficiency, gives us very, very high efficiency. It gives us all the heat we need, all the hot water we need, and we've got the power we need to run the systems. If I choose to add batteries, which I haven't decided on yet, then potentially you've got a buffer against, and providing you have the right switchgear in, you've got a buffer against power loss from the grid. A whole load of advantages, but PV just works. It's simple.
So we're unlikely to see many passive house premiums going down that route of, say, a wind turbine, because as you've said, it's just that is the least obtrusive. It's part of the house. So that's another thing. It keeps it all contained in one area. But you could do that in certain locations and under certain circumstances. And you could do water, I don't know, some sort of turbine. That could be another route, an Archimedes screw.
Yeah, I mean, it's like all things, you know, a house should match its site and the house is site dependent. If you've got a stream or a river that's got enough flow, or if you've got the appropriate water sources, then you can put a turbine in, great. There's a turbine just down the road from my house. You know, we're not on that stream, but somebody else is, and there's a 35 kilowatt cross flow turbine producing energy. Yes, if you're in the right place and nobody objects and you want to stick up a wind turbine, why not? If you've got the wind speed, we've only just about got adequate wind speeds anyway in my area, so it would have been very marginal. It's about horses for courses. You look at your site, you look at your building, and then you look at your energy supplies and energy sources for that, and you choose what's most appropriate. And I would reiterate something that Nick Grant always said, which is keep it simple. You know, it's always a good rule. Don't overcomplicate it, and there's less to go wrong.
Now, you'd done a lot of work for PH15, hadn't you? Was that an obvious choice?
Absolutely. I'd worked with Jay and Jonathan and co for a lot of years since we met training as passive house consultants. So I knew their system. They'd achieved what I'd failed to achieve. I'd been working with a contractor and other people who were doing very similar things. And the first and only house I personally certified and designed was built in a very similar way, using similar type timber structures. But what Jay and co have achieved was they've managed to get it to that complete system approach, and it works. So many of the bits that are normally redesigned every time, people continually reinventing the wheel, we're not doing that. It means we know what how they're going to perform. We don't have to do a lot of expensive work to design them, and we know they work, and we can carry on educating people to how to do it so that they don't make mistakes. You know, if you can avoid a mistake, you save money. And I think that's proven by a lot of the contractors that have built PH 15 houses, that a lot of them have no experience of passive house, no experience of airtightness, and yet they achieve it. They build the houses, they achieve it.
And this would probably be a good point just to give an overview. How does it work? How does the system come together?
The PH 15 system is essentially as simple as you can make a timber structure. So it's structural I-beams, which give the physical strength and form to the building, with a layer on the outside, which is insulation, but it's closing the cavity, and a layer on the inside, which is closing the cavity. It's the racking board, it's the airtightness and vapor permeability layer. So you've essentially got three sides of a box, fill it with more processed wood in the form of insulation, and that's it. So there's 85% of that structure is insulation. It's structurally sound. It's made of natural materials. It's airtight. It's not got thousands of layers. It's not got any plastic in it. It's not got complex building problems. You know, the first couple of weeks, all you're doing is screwing things together. You're not even having to cut stuff. So, you know, I describe it to clients as an IKEA flat pack house. It just comes on a truck instead of in a box. But it's the same principle. You take part A, screw it to part B, add part C, and off you go.
And then what happens as we go up a level and build upwards?
Yeah, the great thing about PH15 and the shell is that as you go up different floors, the internal floors are essentially hung on the inside. Sometimes you'll build one floor and then the next, but quite often you're building all the way up. The shell height, the components are for the full height of the building. So if you've got an 8-meter building, you will have an 8-meter structural element going from floor to ceiling. And then when you've completed the frame, the structural frame with the internal membrane and the external membrane, you then use ledger beams to hang your internal floors off. And the great thing about this is they're inside the airtightness layer. The airtightness layer is the first thing on the inside, and it's continuous. And this is the important thing about low energy buildings, is that insulation and airtightness layers need to be continuous to work. So you just carry on up, put in the ledger beams, put in the intermediate floors, and carry on up.
And then the roof?
The roof is the same as the walls, essentially. It's a portal frame structure. So the same I-beams that are going upwards for the walls are going across or down the pitch for the roof. If you think of an agricultural barn, it's basically a steel portal frame. It goes up, across, and down again. And ours is exactly the same. It's just built in timber. So very, very simple. Screwed and glued together. That's it.
Yeah, I just wanted to illustrate because I've seen it all myself. But let's go to the bit that can vary a bit. So what happens at the ground? And I don't know, maybe we should be coming back to your project here. What choices did you have on your project?
Where the superstructure of the house accounts for maybe, in our case, I don't know, about 7 tons of carbon. In a masonry house, it might be 20 tons of carbon. The groundworks and a concrete foundation and floor can be 40, 50 tons or more. So one of the things we looked at very early on was, how do we get rid of concrete? We'd already been talking to some degree about using things called ground anchors, which are like metal screw nailing the building to the floor. They're long metal rods holding plates, which the building sits on, a bit like mini piles, screw piles, helical piles. When you do that, you have to come above ground and ventilate underneath, because you've essentially got a timber suspended floor instead of a concrete slab. This is what we were hoping to use, but it is proving expensive and complex in terms of how to build it. So I'm not sure whether we'll be able to do that yet. The original type of flooring most people are using is a modification of a standard strip foundation. So you dig a trench, you pour a bit of concrete in, you build a cavity block work, and you pour a slab over insulation. And that's what most buildings are tending to have. What we are looking at as a compromise between the two is the substitution of concrete for either low carbon cement, getting rid of the cement, with other materials. So things called chem-free blocks and low carbon pozzolanic materials. So you can make concrete without so much carbon. And lime, so limecrete, which uses lime instead of cement. And combined with foam glass insulation instead of plastics. Again, costs go up, performance comes down a bit. They can be made to work, but they do come at a price. We're going to have to look very hard at that. Volume use and volume adoption of these things will bring prices down. That's always the way.
And did you say you were on a slope as well?
Yes, we are. Not a terrible one, but I think the one decision I would make differently if I were to start this project today is that we decided early on that we were going to excavate and produce a flat site to build the house on, partly because we wanted to slightly drop the house into the landscape, not just from an aesthetic point of view, but from a sheltering point of view. And that means moving quite a lot of earth around. We're going to try and keep all the earth on the site, but it still means moving earth. So that decision would have been to maybe potentially follow the gradient, which is where the ground anchor system comes in. But again, we didn't do that. So we are going to have to excavate. So we're going to be digging down maximum about a meter and a half to ground floor level. That spoil becomes part of the landscaping project, which is also about retaining water on site. And it's reasonably well-drained soil. It sits in a position between a wooded ridge above to the north and lower-lying agricultural lands below to the south. So it's a sort of an intermediate place, and water runs through. What we're aiming to do is to reconfigure the landscape with a series of swales and two ponds in order to gather that water before it penetrates quite so far down the site, move it around the site, retain it on site for horticulture to some degree, and then the house itself should be absolutely fine. It shouldn't have any issues. So it's not a flood area or anything like that. So we're pretty comfortable with that.
And biodiversity, I remember you earlier saying how you were just encouraging the ecologists, what can we do? We'll do this, we'll do this. Well, it's amazing how quickly, with different planting plans and all the rest of it, the costs can escalate. So where have you ended up? How did you design this space? And what do you think it's going to be of your total budget?
I haven't budgeted it yet, if I'm honest. And I'm seeing it as a separate budget because it's quite a big job. We're dealing with a whole site of 2.5 acres, 1 hectare. The area around the house, which is, if you like, the sort of so-called private garden area, is probably less than 0.5 acre. But what we have done is we have developed a landscape plan for the whole site, which involves quite a lot of tree planting and establishing more than grassland in order to improve biodiversity, which was always part of a plan anyway before the house came on the scheme. The plan was for a forest garden, essentially. What we're going to be doing is really covers two areas. Firstly, it's boundaries and hedges. We've already planted some hedges. We've been maintaining hedges over the last 10 years and improving them, all of which helps wildlife and specifically bats. And we got a lot of bats. We're in right next to very important bat areas for about 6 different species. So although we're going to have to do a little bit of damage to start with, moving a few hedges to get into the site, we're going to be replanting those and improving them. And that gives us biodiversity gains of around about 65% in the hedge areas, not 10% that the developers are being held to. The rest of the site will have a new defined meadow area that will be grass, wildflowers, with quite a few areas of trees, understory shrubs, and so forth. And that gives us, by our calculations, a net gain in biodiversity of over 120%. And we're already, through the work we've already done on site, maintaining no chemicals, leaving the meadow areas uncut, they cut once a year for hay. We've already seen an increase in some species, such as some of the birds, kestrels specifically, and so forth. But what it's going to cost, I've no idea.
What about cost overall then? Because you said in the beginning you perhaps didn't fully realise what you were getting into with the Para 84. So you've got that to contend with. The house has grown a bit over time. You've still got very ambitious targets in performance and generation. Has the budget developed at all in any way, or are you sitting happy? How are things?
Prices have gone up massively since COVID. That's across the board. So we had to revise our thinking there. I was quite happy working on a budget per square metre for the building of between 1,800 and 2,000 a metre, with a look to reduce that by sweat equity somewhat. We're now looking certainly north of 2,500 per square metre. I would be very unhappy if I felt we were going to be up at 3,000. So we're currently beginning to develop the costings on today's numbers. And we will look at every way that we can manage costs down. So I will be project managing this with a small team. So we're not going to be putting a lot of work out to other contractors and then subbing out. You know, there won't be a long string of subcontractors who are going to be all be adding their bit and racking the cost up. We're going to commission stuff from local people where possible directly, so that they're getting paid and we're saving money, and we're putting the time in and the energy in so that we can get the cost savings. But it is always going to be a little bit of an unknown until we've got detailed costings and we're actually building and we see what happens. There are certain aspects like landscaping, which I'm doing separately, and there are one or two slightly higher cost budget items that will make a difference to this building, such as 100 metre main supply that other people might not encounter. My aim is to have costings that inform people so they can say, well, that applies to me and that doesn't, which is always difficult. You never know what the basis that people have calculated it on is.
So how are the energy levels? You've mentioned retirement already. We've talked about what seems a big project and quite a draining 5 years. So how are you at this stage?
I'm good. I'm fine. I'm fine. I mean, you know, I'm lucky. I've got good health and, you know, I've always been pretty active. And sometimes I think you just need the right project. If you're stuck into something and it's moving forward and it's working, then you don't notice that. I'm very aware that building projects go through a hiatus somewhere in the middle, that, you know, partway through you wonder why the hell you started and whether you'll ever get to the end. I'm aware of that. I've seen it. So you just got to be prepared for it and get on with it, really. I'm setting the build program to about 18 months rather than the sort of year that would be quite possible, on the basis that I don't think we should put pressure on ourselves. So, yeah, it's all about managing your own expectations as well.
What do you think has been the biggest challenge to date?
Planning.
Yeah.
I have a lot of sympathy for planning departments. They are massively under-resourced. They really have a workload that they can't cope with, and they have an unbelievable burden of complex regulation, policy, national policy, local policy, things that conflict between one hand and the other hand. One person saying you've got to have this, the other person saying you've got to have that, and they've got to make decisions. So I have a lot of sympathy. But the end result for the individual especially is that the system doesn't work, frankly, and they get caught between all these different things. The big boys, the big developers just throw money at banging it through. You know, they'll take everything to appeal and essentially sidestep the planning process on the basis of housing supply need. It's very difficult to do that as an individual. So yeah, the planning process is the hardest bit. I always said to my clients, if you've got planning and land, you've got 60% of the job done.
And what is left of the planning? Because you sounded quite confident that you were going to get planning permission.
Yeah, it was to do with the complexity of a thing called the Shadow Habitat something or other assessment, HRA, which my ecologist has to do some work and a load of calculations to prove that we're okay, that we're doing the right things, sends it to the county ecologist, who looks at it, says, yeah, I think that's great, we should adopt this, but we have to now send it to Natural England for them to approve as well. So it's not even in the hands of the planning department, it's in the hands of another organisation. Wow. Elsewhere. When and if they say yes, the rubber stamp comes down.
It's extraordinary. So has there been a feeling as you spend your money on planning when you can start to relax a bit almost? Because you're talking a lot of money, so you're starting to feel more confident after 70% or 80%.
Everything I do up till I get that planning approval is done at my risk. For example, we have to have an archaeologist on site during the digging the holes. I've got to pay for that. To do that, he's also got to produce a strategy to say how he's going to do it. I've got to pay for that. Now, till I've got planning, if I pay for that now, I could lose it. If I don't get planning, I've wasted that money. But essentially, as soon as that approval comes through, those risks are over. I now, all I have to do is fulfill all the requirements of the build. So there are 22 planning conditions, and about four of those have to be discharged before we even go on site. So there is a lot of work to do, but it's predictable. And the other thing that does, from a monetary point of view, it means I now have certainty. I have a piece of land with planning permission that if I suddenly fell under a bus and couldn't do this, I can sell that for considerably more than I could before. So again, this is all about risk. Prior to planning approval, all the risk is sitting on me, and you have to have a very patient attitude as far as possible. You have to have deepish pockets to pay for it, unfortunately, but you've just got to hang on there and bottle your way through it.
Well, it's been fantastic to hear all this preparation, and we're sending lots of good luck your way. And we do hope that we can catch up with you another time. Phil, thank you very much.
Thank you. Good to talk.
Head online to take a look at the show notes for this session, houseplanninghelp.com/381, where you can review the key points in the summaries. We always give you these with our conversations. You can take a look at Phil's plans, all that work that's gone in. And I can update you with some good news that he did get planning permission. So he's now working through all of those various conditions to discharge those and get underway. Keep going, Phil. Links to Passive House Homes. We've done a couple of podcasts with Jay over the years from Passive House Homes. So we'll link all of those into our show notes today, houseplanninghelp.com/381. My call to action is to check out The Hub. And this is the membership community that we run alongside House Planning Help. The idea being that we're trying to simplify the self-build journey, just prepping you up more for what lies ahead, filling in some of the gaps, because it's a big project. And I thought today we ought to mention one of our in-depth video case studies, because we've been talking about PH15, and we did actually film the construction of Buckinghamshire Passive House. So we've got 20 chapters, 20 videos, about 10 to 15 minutes that you can work your way through. So you'll get an idea of how it comes together. I think from that whole project, what really stands out for me is the foreman, Wayne, who'd never tackled a Passive House project before. And he challenged himself to get really, I'm going to get the best result ever on the air tightness. And you know what? Paul Jennings, the air leakage expert, it was his best result. So Wayne did incredibly well, and it just goes to show that these system approaches are a very good idea. We've got lots more in the Hub. We've got Ask the Expert. We can pitch your own questions, get some answers there. The courses that try to explain different areas of building a house. The forum allows you to interact with other like-minded individuals. Maybe you want to chat to me in office hour. Live training with guest experts. We try to make it a comprehensive experience. Find out more, houseplanninghelp.com/join. Next time, Ben Nova from Hawkland is my guest. We're going to be looking at health and safety on site and the role of the principal designer. Thanks so much for being there. Enjoy this. The House Planning Help podcast is produced by Regen Media. content that matters.